north of 3, 70 degrees in both Racine and Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 8:10, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. Support for the morning show comes from Carthage College, welcoming approximately 150 full-time transfer students each year. Eligible Gateway graduates can receive guaranteed admission to Carthage to complete their bachelor's degrees. Transfer to more personalized education in 4 easy steps. More information about admissions and competitive scholarships for transfers is available at carthage.edu/admissions/transfer. Support for WGTD also comes from Jack and Drea. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, newly reimagined for 2019. A unique shopping experience, time and time again, that's what brings you back. More information at jackandrea.com. Jack and Drea, a proud supporter of WGTD's morning show. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Greg. That is a bit of a sampling of one of the great names in rock and roll history, Buddy Holly. And on today's morning show, we're going to be not only looking back on the career of Buddy Holly, but also looking back on the sad end to Buddy Holly's life and career. As many of you know, 60 years ago, earlier this year, Buddy Holly went down in a plane crash in northern Iowa, went down to his death, and also killed were a couple of other very important musicians who were with him on his final concert tour, including the Big Bopper and Ritchie Valens. On today's morning show, we're going to be talking with WGTD's own Dave McGrath, news director here, and his wife, Guida Brown, who's been on the morning show any number of times. We're going to be talking about a tour which the two of them recently took, a trip they took in which they essentially paralleled or followed, traced the final concert tour of Buddy Holly, and visiting all of the cities and communities where those young musicians played, and all the way to Clear Lake, Iowa, where it all ended so tragically. And by the way, this is a concert tour that included Kenosha, Wisconsin. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, there are a lot of things that are worth exploring for the next few minutes. I don't think 45 minutes will be nearly enough. But Dave McGrath and Guida Brown, we welcome you both to the morning show.
Thanks morning. For having
Thanks,
us,
Greg.
Greg.
Yeah.
I'm glad you thought this was a good idea. I thought it was a great idea to have you come on and talk about this. Dave, I suspect the idea of doing this originated with you.
You're wrong. Well, sort of, kind of, in a way. The harebrained idea was Guida's.
Really?
On the tour with Buddy Holly, Ritchie, as you mentioned, Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper, but Dion, was the fourth bill on that show. He had just had one hit at that point in his career, so he was not a star, but he still had the hit. And I think, as most people know, Gwynn and I worked with Dion. We've worked with him 25, 30 years. But it was her idea. I grew up in that era, so this was music that I enjoyed, I listened to. I dragged her into that era when she started to work with Gene Pitney and Peter Noon and then Dion. And she came to me one day and said, let's do it. Let's do the Winter Dance Party tour.
I really wanted to do it in order.
But I had more common sense.
Yeah. So David figured out the tour. But while we were on it, I had gone back into the favorites on my cell phone, the pictures. And it was 2 years ago we started planning this, where I found the list of all the venues and said, you know, we should do this trip. We should go to all of the places where the Winter Dance Party went before the plane went down. So,
wow. Yeah. So I'm completely wrong. Thank you for correcting me. That's a great story in and of itself. Ahead of us talking about this final tour, I think it's really important for us to talk about, first of all, talk about Buddy Holly, who he was and his importance. And I think for anybody who knows anything about the history of rock and roll, they're certainly going to know Buddy Holly. Mm-hmm. But for people who are more into Mozart and other things, they might not really understand just how significant this young man was in rock and roll in the late 1950s. So set the stage for us.
Sure. Before we launch into that, I always like to make it clear that Gwynn and I are not Buddy Holly experts. We're not Ritchie Valens experts, Big Bopper experts. Although we've been in the music business since 1985, we're not music business experts, because listening out there will be a Buddy Holly expert hanging on every word.
Lucky you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and because it's radio, I brought the book called The Day the Music Died, written by, I believe his name is Larry Lemer. Mm. So Buddy Holly emerged in late 58, 1959, maybe as early as 1957. And as Larry points out in the book, in 1959, Elvis Presley was in the Army. Chuck Berry was in jail for tax evasion. Little Richard had become a minister, had left music to become a minister. And Jerry Lee Lewis had married his 13-year-old cousin, and nobody would play his records. So
And the Beatles still hadn't made it.
No. Mm. Yeah, this is long before the Beatles. So that sets the stage for somebody to emerge.
There's a vacuum.
Yep. And Buddy Holly happened to be the guy. And he came out of Lubbock, Texas, after a couple of frustrating starts with Decca Records, who recorded him in Nashville, and he hated it. He originally recorded That'll Be the Day in Nashville with Nashville country musicians. He hated it. Hmm. He loved the song. He hated what they did to it. He later re-recorded it, which became the hit. But he was there. He was a guy. He was this small-town guy, sort of all-American looks, short hair. He wore the silly horn-rimmed glasses, non-threatening to adults, to parents. And he was singing little songs. I mean, he advanced. His music advanced rapidly. But, you know, his first big hit was Peggy Sue. If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know, blah, 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 blah. And it was non-threatening music, and it was very melodic, very catchy, and in 1959, as needed for the radio, very short, 2.5-minute records. And he just kept coming up with them. You know, That'll Be the Day, Peggy Sue, Rave On, Oh Boy. And then as his music progressed, he was doing songs like, which we didn't get to in that medley, and adding, besides the standard bass, lead guitar, and drums, he was starting to experiment. He put a glockenspiel on it every day. And then he started using horns and strings on
a different song.
True Love Ways. Just a gorgeous, gorgeous song. And so he was emerging, and he was also advancing and writing better songs. And at the point in 1959 where he took the Winter Dance Party tour, Buddy was in a tough place in his life where he was having, from what I read, again, I'm not a Buddy Holly expert, but anything you read, he was desperate for money because he wanted to start his own studio. He wanted to start his own record company. He was tired of being controlled. He had problems with his manager, a guy named Norman Petty, who was cut out of the same cloth as Colonel Tom Parker, the man who controlled Elvis Presley. So he's having trouble with his marriage, having trouble with his manager. He's having financial troubles. And he had done, before the Winter Dance Party, this operation was called General Artists Corporation, who promoted these shows. They'd done a summer dance party, which he had been on. He needed the money, and he took the show. Didn't want to do it. Nobody wants to be in the Midwest in the winter. But he took the money, and he took the tour, and that's why he ended up where he did when he did.
Hmm. What's your understanding about, then, who created this and how these other musicians were drawn in? Was this already a package to which Buddy Holly attached himself, or was he, in a sense, kind of the headliner, and these other people came aboard?
So my sense, he was the headliner, and these other guys, Richie Valens. Richie, at that point, had three hits, 17 years old. Three hit records.
Hmm.
He died 3 months before his 18th birthday.
Wow.
And he had three huge hits. La Bamba, still a huge. It's been re-recorded three or four times. He did a beautiful song called Donna, and he did another one, Come On, Let's Go. The Big Bopper was pretty much a novelty act, but he had had a number one hit called Chantilly Lace. And again, all these guys are working cheap. You know, Buddy Holly was maybe probably making $1,000 a night, which I don't know what that is in 2019 dollars, but these other guys are making $500 a night, $250 a night. And it's the birth of rock and roll. They want to perform. You're a performer. You want to do what you do. So General Artists Corporation put together this package. Again, Dion had one hit at that time, so he's on the package. And then there was a guy named Frankie Sardo who kind of functioned as an MC. And he did a couple of songs to start every show. But so that was the package. That was the five and why they were out there.
So it's a crowded night. I mean, all of these guys are playing on all of these concerts.
Yep. Yep.
Wow.
It was a two-hour show every night, unless somebody decided to ad-lib and go off the set list. But generally, these were two-hour shows.
Fascinating. Let's remind people, first of all, about the singing of Richie Valens. Boy, that is a sweet, pure voice, isn't it?
And again, 17 years old, three hit records. And back in 1959, these artists, all the way through the Beatle era, they had to keep producing records because these records raced up and down the charts in 3 months. So generally, an artist could have three or four hits in a year just to sustain their popularity and be able to go out on tour. So again, 17-year-old kids writing that stuff in 1959.
Wow. Not bad. The three who we lost in 1959, most people know the least about J.P. Richardson, also known as the Big Bopper. Yeah. You called him kind of a novelty act?
Well, he was a disc jockey out of Texas. He worked around Port Arthur and Beaumont. His real name was, Giles Perry Richardson. They called him J.P. or Jape. He didn't want to be a recording star. He dabbled in it. He did this thing, this novelty song called Chantilly Lace. Somehow it got played at this station and then that station, and all of a sudden it became a regional hit, and then he got picked up, by Mercury Records, but I'm not sure. And it went to number one in the country. Hmm. And they needed another act who could work cheap, and JP was their guy, and so he was added to the tour.
So here he is, the Big Bopper.
Chantilly Lace and a pretty face and a pony tail hanging down, wiggle in the walk and a giggle in the talk. Make the world go round.
I guess I've heard that song somewhere in the way back of my mind. And finally, Buddy Holly, we started at the point with just a little bit of this medley that you put together. So let's hear it in its entirety. But is there anything you want to say, and Guida, join in if you like, in terms of the singing of Buddy Holly and what made him so effective?
Well, Guida can jump in. at the end of the medley, so you're going to hear what, the one you played earlier on. You heard his early rock and roll hits. He came out of Texas, so he had a country twinge to him. He had some of that Tex-Mex, and then he added his flavor of rock and roll. But the last two songs you're going to hear is you're going to hear where Buddy decided to grow up and mature. You're going to hear Every Day, which has a glockenspiel, and you're going to hear The True Love Ways, which I think the Drifters were maybe the first rock act to use strings on their songs, but I think Buddy was right there with the strings and the horns, which you would never hear on a rock and roll song, on the song called True Love Ways.
So he was growing,
clearly. Quickly, yeah, very quickly.
Yeah. Anything you want to add about what you
like? No. I was -6 when Buddy Holly went out. So, yeah, no.
So a late comer to the Buddy Holly fan club. Here he is.
Getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way. Hey, hey, hey. Just you know why. Why you and I will by and by. No true love ways. Sometimes we'll sigh.
Wow, one would never guess that is Buddy Holly when we think about the songs that he's much better known for. He was really evolving. That's really intriguing. David, before we went on the air, you were saying something about the way in which this tour was put together for Buddy Holly and Dion and the other musicians, and that it was, in a sense, a very unkindly constructed tour that a big star nowadays, it's just laughable to think of them being subjected to these kind of conditions. Explain what was so unreasonable and unkind about this tour, the way it was put together.
Well, I think you know, and a lot of people know, Guida and I worked with a guy named Gene Pitney for many years, and Peter Noon. The critical thing here is this is the dawn of rock and roll. This is 1959. So while people of my era know these guys as big stars, mainstream media didn't look at them as big stars, and these booking tour promoters and booking agents, these are just people that they're going to bring in. Not really sure who they are. I know they got a couple of hit records. So they weren't treated as superstars as, say, you pick three of the biggest stars today. Everybody in the world knows who they are. Mainstream media had no idea who a Buddy Holly was or a Big Bopper. So Guida can probably talk to you about routing, because when it came to Gene Pitney, the tour promoter would give Gene the list of dates, for example, in England. And Gene would look at it and say, no, we're not doing it that way, because – they have them zigzagging back and forth. If you were going to go on vacation and you were going to go to these 12 cities, this is not how you would have put it together. I'm going to let Guida expand on that a little bit, because we had the discussion about should we do it the way the promoters did it to these guys in 1959, before the interstate system, and they're running around on two-lane highways in the middle of winter in Wisconsin.
In broken-down buses, yeah. And that was the other thing. So that they were in these buses that never had proper heat, and they probably didn't realize how cold it was going to be because they were from Texas for the most part. So the tour started in Milwaukee, came down to Kenosha, went up to went over to Minneapolis, and then it kept going back and forth. And then it went over to, you know, Green Bay and Appleton, and then it went back over to Minneapolis, and then from Iowa, they were actually going to
Duluth.
Yeah, I mean, it was just, it was all over the place. So when I joke that I wanted to do it in order, just for whatever reason. When we did the numbers on the mileage, it was 2,600 miles. And then David did it in proper order, and it was down to 1,600.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, they were just all over the place, and so it had no bearing on where you were before. It was just where you could get the next date.
Right. So it was, in a sense, 1,100 miles more than it needed to be or should have been.
Yep.
Wow.
In the winter, on two-lane highways, in a broken-down bus.
Yeah. So you were saying that you've been planning this for 2 years. Give our listeners some sense of what was involved in the planning phase of this.
Well, we'd been talking about it for 2 years. I had planned for it in that I said, David, we should do this. And then then life happened. And then when we decided, it was around March this year when we decided, okay, we're going to do
it. Got serious.
And then David he always does all the work on our vacations. And so he plotted the whole thing out, and it was so much fun. It was such a great trip, even though we did the trip information, and I think we were in the car for 32 hours and, 1,600
miles. And what married couple, married 23 years, doesn't want to spend 30 hours in a car with each other? She's not laughing, is she?
21 years. 21.
So one overarching question I have is, are all of the venues that were part of this tour, do they still exist, or are some of the actual structures gone by now?
They don't exist. There were 11 sites. There were 11 cities, not counting Appleton, because Appleton never happened. But it was on the original tour.
So that was the next thing. Okay.
No, it was on the original tour, but because the bus had broken down up in Hurley, Wisconsin. Or up near Hurley, Wisconsin, they couldn't. It was a 1 o'clock show in Appleton and a 7 o'clock show in Green Bay.
So they had to cancel it.
Yep. So they had to cancel that first show, and then they got them down to Green Bay. So we went to all 12 cities, and I would say six the locations still exist, but because of the history of it, we went to two places and couldn't find anything. Fond du Lac, La Crosse, one of those, Eau Claire. It's a parking lot. It's a parking lot that's supposed to have a marker, and there was no marker. And
wow.
Yeah.
A historical marker.
Yeah.
Right.
And in a couple other cities, we didn't even have the right address. We ended up, because of the internet, and people said, oh, it's here, and then we ended up at the wrong place, and then somebody came out of a vape shop and said, no, it's not here. It's two blocks down, So you go there, and there's either nothing there, there's another building there. There was an Abra auto body shop in one of them that they had, completely disseminated the building. And then there were other buildings that were in the process of being repaired. Green Bay has the Riverside Ballroom, beautiful ballroom. Kenosha still has the Eagles, the Marina Shore is beautiful. And
the fabulous surf ballroom.
And Mankato ballroom is still there and has been operational the whole time.
So this is kind of interesting because I pretty much figured that not every place they played was still a place where people do music, but I kind of half expected that most of the buildings would at least be standing, and it sounds like in at least several cases, even the building, there is no trace whatsoever. Do you have any sense of how many people do this? Is this a thing that rock and roll fans tend to do, like Major League Baseball fans of a certain breed visit every single stadium in their lives or whatever? I mean, is this a common thing for fans to do?
When I called around to a couple of chambers of commerce to get some information, they knew what I was looking for, so I think they get hit and miss. Hmm. I'm not sure everybody does the venues prior to the plane crash. However, the crash site is marked. in Iowa, in the middle of the cornfield in Iowa, outside of Clear Lake. And when we were there, when we visited, there was constant people coming and going. It's a private farm, but the people who own the farm have made it clear that this is a historic site, and they welcome the public. And there's a marker that a fan from Wisconsin had made a marker where the crash site is. So the day we were there, it was a constant flow of people. Wow. And the Surf Ballroom, which was the last venue of that tour, is now a nonprofit. It's still an operating concert venue, but it's also a museum, which is just jam-packed with not only memorabilia about the Winter Dance Party tour, but rock and roll in general. And the Surf Ballroom is wide open. You can walk in. You can go on that stage.
Yeah. Wow.
You can be on that stage. You can go in that dressing room. And I think some people know, maybe not all, but at many dressing rooms at concert venues across the country, entertainers sign the walls. There's autographs from fabulous entertainers in the walls. And the green room at Surf Ballroom is just loaded with signatures from unbelievable people.
Wow. How cool. For those of you just joining us, my guests on the morning show, well, first, you know one of the voices extremely well. That is of Dave McGrath, our news director. And his wife, Guida Brown, has been on the morning show quite a number of times as well. They're both on the morning show today to talk about a really intriguing trip that they took at the end of July, a self-crafted trip that paralleled the last tour of Buddy Holly before his tragic death in a plane crash in northern Iowa in the winter of 1959. So let's just kind of talk our way a bit through the trip that you took. And again, you did not go to these locations in the same order that Buddy Holly and his colleagues did. You made a more sensible traversal of all these places. So that means you didn't go to Milwaukee and then drive down to Kenosha, obviously. Did you actually take the time to swing by the Eagles Club in Kenosha?
Oh, gosh, absolutely. So Mark Wilde, who is the catering business and manages the building, he is a friend of ours. And so I had actually texted him to see if he was going to be there because the trip, we rented a car. I told David, the trip doesn't start until we have the rental car. We're not, you know, you're not, let's just swing over to the Eagles and take a picture or whatever. And says, no, the trip doesn't start until we have the rental car. So that was our first stop. I had texted Mark to see if he was going to be there. He didn't respond. He always responds. And so we figured, we'll just check it out. We'll go. And we know how to get in. And so we walked in, and Mark heard us walking in and gave us pretty much free run. Yeah, go. The photographer, what was his name?
Tony Zickel.
Okay. So they have pictures of the dance party up that Tony Zickel, who was a Kenosha photographer, had taken. Mark told us a great story. He was doing a wedding in the mezzanine and was supposed to be there until 10 o'clock. And he said, I got to get upstairs. And the wedding party said, no, you need to take these pictures. And he said, okay, stayed as long as he could, went upstairs, took the pictures. And these pictures are iconic. They're everywhere. They're at the Surf Ballroom. They're in every book you'll ever see. And so we went and we took the pictures, and because of our work with Dion, we would, you know, point at every picture of Dion and put it on Facebook, because if it's not on Facebook, it didn't happen. And and so, yeah, we spent time looking. And Marina Shores is beautiful. They've done a beautiful job of keeping it intact and you know, making it really like you're walking back into time. And so it's a beautiful venue. And
so it was a wonderful way to start this.
Yeah, it was really a lot of fun. And then we just said, okay, now number two, we're going up to the rave.
And tell us about what you saw in Milwaukee then.
We saw the outside of the building. there were a lot of outsides of buildings, yeah. So we went to the rave. There was a show
Which is
night.
The former George Devine's Million Dollar Ballroom.
Yeah. Right.
And has been that my other thing in the process of this was trying to figure out which of these venues had been operational 100% of the time. And that was a thwarted effort for the most part. The rave had off and on. There were a couple closed downs and then rehabs and back. But so the building is intact. Shows there still regularly. But that night, they were setting up for something they wouldn't let us in. So we took our pictures in the front, right. And then we went around the back by the loading dock and took some pictures back there.
So you guys know a lot of people, but you don't know everybody.
No, yeah, couldn't get in there, right?
From Milwaukee, where did you go?
Then we went to the Riverside Ballroom in Green Bay, and that's beautiful. There was actually a quinceañera going on there. They had spent $40,000 at the Riverside to rehab their lobby to make it a memorial for the winter dance party. So they had some original prints, pictures, things like that. And it's a beautiful, beautiful venue, beautiful venue. They invited us in. Again, we didn't want to interrupt the quinceañera, but we went in and we took some pictures.
What's a quinceañera?
It's a typically the Latina girls, when they turn 15 years old, it's a 15th birthday party.
Okay, yeah. Right. Very good.
And the Riverside has a stainless steel, I don't call them sculptures,
Memorial
out in front. It's one of the few places that actually has retained the legacy that they were part of the winter dance party, and they've got a beautiful stainless steel memorial in front of the building.
Taking it seriously.
Yeah.
Yep. Very good. Where'd you go from Green Bay?
Then we went to Appleton, right?
I think we stopped at Appleton on the way up just because it's a venue that they didn't do, and the venue is gone, so it was just a quick picture, and then we went up to Green Bay. And then we headed to Eau Claire. Yep.
Okay.
Eau Claire was
parking lot.
Yeah.
But they had at one point back in like 2003 had put up a historical marker. I knew it was a parking lot because I talked to their Chamber of Commerce, and we knew we were in the right place, but the historical marker disappeared. So we overnighted in Eau Claire, and then we schlepped all the way to St. Paul. They had played the St. Paul Armory. The prom ballroom. And I got to point out, a lot of these places were ballrooms they played, because now you have to remember, you're coming out of the 1940s and 1950s, and so all the big bands would play all these ballrooms. So the ballrooms were pretty much the only real, besides the old vaudeville theaters, like with the proscenium art stage, there were just ballrooms that could hold these big crowds of, at that point, big crowds, 2,000 people. So a lot of these venues were old ballrooms. And so they played the prom ballroom in St. Paul. That's now gone. That's an auto body shop. And then, we spent a couple hours visiting your cousin.
Yeah, we did.
Who was outside of St. Paul. And then it was up to Duluth, where they played the Duluth Armory. And that was one of the highlights of the tour.
Duluth, the city.
Duluth, we were surprised. You know, when you say Duluth, Minnesota, you figure, it's a wonderful little city.
Arctic Circle, but there's a lot there that's a
wonderful little city.
And the armory is being rehabbed. So right now, there's nothing going on in there, but they're trying to make it an art center. So the building's still there.
Yep. Overnighted in Duluth, then there's a long 5-hour drive from Duluth to a little place called Montevideo, Minnesota. I think most people know Montevideo, Uruguay. Well, this is their sister city, and we've anglicized it to Montevideo.
Okay.
That's where we had trouble finding the venue, because the information I had from the internet gave us one address. When we got there at that address, it was a building that had been a ballroom, but had been a different ballroom. So now we're snooping around, looking, and a couple of guys walk out. It's now a vape shop. Guys came out, and they're very polite. They say, "Hey, can we help you?" So, you got to go through the whole thing. We're retracing the Buddy Holly winter dance party. "Oh, no, you're okay. It's three doors down." So there were two ballrooms, within a two-block period.
That says something about that era, doesn't it?
Right, absolutely.
Because it's a relatively small community and would have two of them.
So that facility is gone. It's now a school, a very small school.
So that building is not there at all.
Right.
And then from Montevideo down to Mankato, Minnesota, which is another 3-hour trip. And the Cato Ballroom was kind of special to Guido and I, because when we started to do the merchandising for the artists, the first guy we worked with was Peter Noon from Hermits Hermits. The first show we ever did was at the Cato Ballroom in Mankato, Minnesota. So that kind of brought us full circle. And of course, neither one remembered it. We completely forgot what the venue looked like. We completely forgot anything involving us there. It was closed it was not open for business when we got there. So, you know, took a couple of pictures. And then what we always did was went and got the backstage entrance as well for photos, because obviously that's where the artists were.
Presumably that's where Buddy Holly and company would have walked through.
Yeah, and I'll let Guida pick it up from Mankato.
After Mankato, we went to Clear Lake. And so that's where the last show was, in Clear Lake. And then the plane went down right outside of the city in a farm field, as David mentioned. But it reminded me of Father Flanagan's Boys Town. If you've ever been to Nebraska.
Omaha?
Yeah. That's where Father Flanagan, from the TV shows, the old Mickey Rooney, let's hold a dance in the barn kind of thing. And Father Flanagan, St. Francis of Assisi, whoever followed these people were brilliant marketers, and they kept everything. And so the Surf Ballroom, they kept everything. They had to have known, somebody had to have known, had the prescient knowledge to say, this is important. And they kept everything. And
you mean inside the building? Is that what you're talking about?
On display.
Inside the building, on display, just fascinating. One of the best was, there was a Xeroxed picture from Kenosha in Dion's handwriting. It's a note to Waylon Jennings, who was one of the crickets on that show, on the whole dance party. And it says,
Waylon.
Someone sent me this picture. You know, there you are rocking. And then it just, you know, you're still doing great, blah, blah, blah. Has Dion's address and phone number on it.
Whoa.
Yeah. And I was like, wow, is that cool?
His current address and phone number.
And it was pre 2015, 14, 15, because the estate, Waylon Jennings had died and the estate turned it over.
Okay.
And the David is someone. He's the one who had sent this to Dion. And And so it was so funny. And then there was a check receipt to the union in Kenosha, the musicians union in Kenosha, for like $1.43, written by that they had received money from JP Richardson, and had, you know, he had to pay them $1.43. I mean, so there was just all of this memorabilia that I think anybody who's interested in this era of music should go there to the Surf Ballroom, because it's absolutely fascinating. It's interactive in a way that you're not playing with a phone or listening to something. Like David said, you can go on the stage. You get to go into the green room. You could. They have all the booths that are still there. It was seriously so cool. And then they give you the directions to get to the crash site, and you have to walk about a half a mile into a farm field. And like David said, there's a memorial there. There's a memorial now to the pilot as well, because the pilot was a young 21-year-old who also died, that nobody necessarily pays attention to. And so there's a memorial to him there as well. And it's just a farm field. It's a cornfield today, and then these things right in the middle of it.
In a clear, kind of like Field of Dreams a little bit.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. A little smaller, though, because it's just, seriously, it's a path to get there, and then there are the memorials, and then right behind it is a fence and the corn growing, or whatever's growing at the time.
And are you saying it's a half hour from where you park to walk to
Half mile.
Yeah. Okay.
One of the great things the Surf has done, if anybody ever seen the Buddy Holly Story movie, there's a scene in there where, now everybody's, on the tour, everybody's sick, they're irritated. And Buddy calls his wife, Maria Elena, and telling her, this isn't going well. You know, I'm going to charter this airplane. And they have preserved that phone in that phone booth there.
Really?
You can't use it, and you can't touch it because it's locked. But so they've gone to that extent, and they've got a little sign where Maria Elena has signed it saying, yes, he did call me from this phone.
Wow.
Yeah. It's just very cool, again, for anyone who's interested at all in this era. If you don't have to do the whole tour, but everyone should go to the Surf Ballroom.
Yeah. Now, ahead of you actually going there, how much did you know about what they had done? Or did you not have much sense that there was all of this fascinating stuff to see there?
Oh, about the Surf Ballroom?
Right.
I knew there was a museum. but I didn't know to what extent they had done all this collection. You know, Guido was telling about everything there. They've got Big Bopper's contract that he signed for the Winter Dance Party tour, and just all kinds of amazing things. It's one of those things where it's overwhelming. You know, if you really need 3-4 hours to spend there, if you go, because they have so much stuff, but it's really worth it. Really
and
worth
the it. Other fun thing that they've done, because they've preserved this so well, every February they have a 3-day party, a 3-day concert tour, and so they have all of the posters from each one of those years since they started those. I think they started them in maybe the 80s. And again, it's just they've done such a great job of preserving the memory. That we bought, because I can't pass up junk, we bought a piece of wood from the original dance floor that they sell in the gift shop, because of course there's a gift shop.
And yeah.
Yeah, it really is worth seeing.
Wow. Wow, I am impressed.
Yeah.
That's and it's great that they seemed to early on, as you said, Guida, somebody was prescient.
Yep.
Somebody thought this is even more important than we might realize in this moment, and preserved all of this, and it's in such stark contrast to some of these other places that don't seem to be aware of this whatsoever.
Right.
Dave, we just have a couple of minutes here, but I want you to kind of explain, because it's such an interesting story, why there were three musicians on this plane that crashed right outside of Clear Lake versus the others, and some of the mystery that surrounds who was on that plane and why, and who ended up on the bus and survived.
There's controversy. So what happened? Buddy Holly was fed up. He was not... Again, we know the story now. The crummy buses, the bad routing. He was fighting with his manager. His marriage seemed to be in some turmoil, and you know he was broke, so he's on the tour. He decides he's going to charter an airplane to go to the next venue, which would have been like a 5-hour bus trip. And now his band is Waylon Jennings, guitarist Tommy Alsop, and his drummer Carl Bunch. Carl Bunch isn't on the tour anymore because he's in the hospital in Green Bay with frostbitten toes. So it's Buddy, Waylon, and Tommy. So Buddy's going to charter the plane for his band. Waylon Jennings decides he's going to give up his seat to the Big Bopper because the Big Bopper's got a cold. He's sick. He's an entertainer. He's a star. So Waylon says, take my seat. Tommy Alsop is the other guitar player. The controversy comes. Tommy Alsop says he and Richie Valens decided to do a coin flip for that third seat because it was supposed to be Tommy's because he's part of the Crickets. But Richie's got the flu. He's sick. So they toss the coin, and Richie, we do this in air quotes, wins the toss, and he goes on the airplane. Dion, who we have worked with over and off and on for 25, 30 years, says he was part of the coin toss. And as Dion says, I was there, you weren't. So that's one of those mysteries and one of those things, but Guida has a pretty good perspective on that, the memories.
Yeah, if you didn't talk about it, or if there was a coin toss and you thought, Dion tells the story that the cost for the plane was going to be $37. And he says, I wasn't going to pay $37. That was what my parents were paying for rent every month. That, you know, I wasn't going to pay that much. And so I think anyone who criticizes the memory of somebody from 60 years ago, So I think the story is compelling either way.
Absolutely.
I was there. I thought I was part of the coin toss. I really was part of the coin toss. It doesn't really matter. He gave up his seat. The Waylon Jennings, the story is, Buddy was mad that Waylon had given up his seat to the Big Bopper. And he said, I hope you get frostbite. I hope your bus breaks down. That's what he said. I hope your bus breaks down. Mm. And Waylon said, I hope your plane crashes.
Mm.
And, you know, two guys joking with each other. And Waylon had to live with that for the rest of his life. And and talked about how hard that was. And, you know, this is my friend. And I tell him, the last words I say to him are, I hope your plane crashes. Mm. And then it does.
And then it does. David, you were saying that the mainstream media did not pay as much attention to Buddy Holly and these others, as we might have assumed that they did. What about the plane crash? Did this make headlines, and did this have lasting impact on kind of the general public?
Yes and no. For example, it happened at Clear Lake. Again, when you read Larry Lemer's book, it was off the newspapers in 2 days. Gone. The story was gone. Now, it made national headlines for a day or so because I was 11 years old at the time. I remember it. But then it was gone because, again, rock and roll was in its infancy. If it were to happen to Justin Bieber or Beyonce or whoever today,
right,
go on forever in a day. But I think for the most part, the story disappeared pretty rapidly, especially after the funerals. It was done and gone. So, it was a different time, a different place, and those guys were not given the respect they should have had as the stars they were at the time.
But the other interesting piece of that is it launched the career of Bobby V.
Yeah.
Because once the plane went down, the tour still had to go on.
Mm.
And so they found local artists who would finish up the tour. There were another maybe 10 or so venues that had to be done. And so Bobby V lived up in Minnesota.
Moorhead or Fargo,
somewhere. Moorhead, North Dakota, whatever. And so they put him on the tour. And he was, 15-year-old kid, 16-year-old kid.
Wow.
Who then that launched his career. So, again, a huge era that probably doesn't get as much attention because of the British invasion that happened shortly after, and it's lost to a lot of people that this was so very important.
Wow. As you look back now, overall, are you really glad that you took the time to take this trip, or were there too many kind of disappointments, empty parking lots and so on that, you know, where the delights and the frustrations are in fairly even balance? How would you assess what this was
like?
I'll
say quickly, we had a great time, and we had never spent a lot of time in Iowa, and I know you're from Iowa. We found that to be very serene, very pretty state. Clear Lake's a gorgeous city. Mankato, we had a great time in, that's Minnesota, another place in Iowa. Anyways, the only disappointment we found was the lack of remembrance at so many venues that don't have monuments, that don't have any kind of marker saying we were part of the Winter Dance Party. And without telling tales out of school, we are trying to talk to the Modigliano family about doing something right here in Kenosha at the
Right, because you have to go inside to see it, and it's not always available to be inside. And again, this was a huge era that we think needs to be remembered. I'm thrilled that we went. I thought it was a great trip. I would recommend everyone go again if you don't want to do the whole thing. At least go to Clear Lake. It was really a lot of fun. Probably, I think I had more fun than I probably thought I was going to.
And you get to see places we had never been, even though we've traveled a lot. We've been fortunate to travel a lot. And we got to travel around our own home state and your neighboring states, Minnesota and Iowa. It was just fun. Great fun.
Great. Well, it was really fun to hear all about it today. I appreciate both of you being such good storytellers and knowing so much about this. Not just knowing about what you did on this trip, but knowing sort of the story behind this ultimately really unfortunate concert tour that brought an end to the life and career of Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Richie Valens. Dave McGrath and Gwida Brown, I thank you most sincerely for being part of a really interesting morning show. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to be talking to the author of a book that calls for us to create what he calls a democratic economy. Not capitalism, not socialism, but something else entirely different. And on Friday, I'm very excited. I'm hoping to share multiple interviews with multiple people who attended Woodstock. By the end of this week, it will be to the day, the 50th anniversary of the Woodstock Music Festival. And I have one interview already recorded, and I'm hoping to record a couple more interviews with people who actually experienced Woodstock up close and personal. We want to remind you that the morning show is available as a podcast. You can hear a different morning show 7 days a week with the podcast. It's titled The Morning Show with Greg Berg, and it's available on all of the major podcast platforms, including Spotify, Google Podcast, and Apple Podcast. I'd really appreciate it if you would subscribe